Well, the European Union was established in order to make trade more efficient between European countries, right? This is why the euro was standardized as one currency. It's why passports for member countries allowed free movement between the various states over EU borders. The advent of the union meant that certain laws in the different countries had to be standardized. Otherwise, you would be giving one country an unfair advantage over another. So these laws were codified, and you wouldn't want some things to be forbidden in one country and not another, and then all the trade would go to that country. It makes a lot of sense. But this led to some interesting conundrums. Whether these laws made trade simpler or not, I'll let you decide. Here's some examples. EU regulators made a law that didn't exist before. They suddenly declared that it was illegal to eat your pet horse. You could eat other horses, just not a pet horse, apparently. Food may not be sold by number. It always has to be sold by weight. Now, this sounds harmless until you think of selling eggs. Now, you have to sell them by weight, not by how many you buy. So you can't buy a dozen eggs. You have to buy a certain amount of weight. And that means each egg needs to be individually weighed, and it needs to be stamped in a way that doesn't break the egg. So everyone had to have this all throughout the whole union, and egg farmers had to purchase the standardized equipment to stamp their eggs and weigh their eggs, and also it had to include which chicken laid the egg, I kid you not, in this information, and this equipment cost 5,000 euros each. Another law is that any banana that is sold needs to not be too curved, or you face a fine. Of course, there's no guideline about what curve makes the banana too curved. And so farmers ended up discarding millions of tons of edible bananas because they didn't want to be fined. Others would just ship their bananas and then have to pay fines. Italy alone had to pay 6.74 million euros in banana fines in the first year. The EU made a rule forbidding the distribution of bottled water that included a claim that it cured dehydration, because there has been absolutely no scientific study in Europe categorically proving that water fixes dehydration. So you're not allowed to say that. The reason there's been no study is because it's that obvious. But anyway, they also, the scientists insisted that it should be illegal until thoroughly documented that jam be called jam unless it had 53% sugar. It had to be 60% sugar. Before that, it was 53%. So there was a lady, her name was Clippy McKenna. Clippy McKenna from the United Kingdom decided to stand up to this rule. She made jam. She was famous for making her jam. She'd been exporting it for years. It contained 53% sugar, but now the EU's new law said that you had to document that it contained 60% sugar, which would have made it way too sweet. She didn't want to do that. If it was less than 50% sugar, it had to be called a preserve, not a jam. If it was in between 50 and 60, it had to be called a fruit spread conserve, which is a term nobody uses, and nobody really knew what that was. So her jam was now downgraded to fruit spread conserve, which just sounds like something you don't want to put on, even though it's better than preserve, and it's not as sweet as the sweet jam they wanted. So she started a campaign. It would have cost her money to change labels and to do all that, and she refused to do it. And she lost her American export market, because would you buy something from the UK called fruit spread conserve? No. Nobody would. Ms. McKenna fought this until finally the EU responded by lowering its sugar requirements back to 50%. She says this, "For the past 18 months, I've been fighting this ridiculous red tape, which is why I'm absolutely delighted that the government has agreed to lower the allowed sugar levels to include my fruitastic jams. As a mum, I hope that my experience illustrates to the general public that if you truly believe in something, it's possible to successfully challenge the status quo." Well, whether other men and women will be brave enough to stand up to the European Union is yet to be seen, stand up to tyrannical fruit spread laws, and maybe in 18 months of protesting, a person will be able to legally eat their pet horse if they choose to do so. Anyway, for a biblical account of bravery, a woman standing up to tyrannical and ridiculous laws, a man standing up to that as well. Turn in your Bibles to Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2. And the way you get there, if you're not sure, is you go through Psalms and you back into Job, back into Esther. Esther chapter 2. Now, you'll remember the context here. There's an orphan girl. Her name is Hadassah. That is her Hebrew name. Her Persian name was Esther. She won a Miss World beauty pageant, and the dubious honor of winning the Miss World crown was that she now had to marry the king, King Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes in secular literature. We know that this favor that she had with those judging was favor granted by God, that this winning of the pageant was in fact all part of God's plan, a grand scheme of him moving her into place in order to preserve the Jews from a jam that they would be in. Okay, enough puns about preserves and jams, but we see the next step in God's plan to help these Jews and to be the refuge for the Jews. We see the next step tonight as God moves Mordecai into position. So in a sense, his opening gambit, he moved his queen into position. You know, he promoted her from pawn, an unknown orphan, to queen of the realm. And now he's moving one of his bishops, one of his other leaders, leading characters in this play into place. And we're going to look at two aspects of living in a fallen bureaucracy. If you've ever had to deal with red tape, visa applications, for example, or if you've ever had a standing line at Social Security or the DMV, you know that the curse is in full effect. And we see that here, two aspects of living in a fallen bureaucracy. And then next time we're in Esther, we'll actually see a third where assistance is requested. The first we're going to look at tonight is assassins reported. Secondly, asinine requirements. And then next time we're in Esther, we'll look at assistance requested. So firstly, assassins reported. This is just a little part of the narrative that you need to cover so that you file it away in your memories for later on in the story. This becomes very important. So let me read for you from Esther chapter 2, verse 19 and following. Now, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai, just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. This came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, this event just seems like an irrelevant vignette, a little aside, and at this point in the narrative, that's exactly what it is. It doesn't contribute to the pace of the story yet, but it's an important piece of history that you need to file. So this is what happened. Mordecai, as you remember, is the uncle of the orphan Hadassah. He raises her. Now she's the queen, and he still gets to see her. He's the one that brought her up. So she is like his daughter. He's also a connected man. He's a respected man, and he has his finger on the pulse of what's going on. And he just so happens to get wind of this assassination attempt. And whenever I say the phrase, just so happened, in the book of Esther, what you need to hear is, God providentially ordained that, dot, dot, dot. Because this is what we're learning to do in the book of Esther. The whole point of the book is that God is not mentioned once, he's not even referred to, and yet, in this completely secular, pagan environment, he is very clearly at work through the lives of his people to accomplish his plan for his glory, even though nobody acknowledges it. And maybe you at your work, your place of employment, nobody around you acknowledges anything that God is doing. Everything is luck, good luck or bad luck, or just so happened. But you know that God is at work even in those situations. And that's what we're learning. We're exercising our eye muscles of faith in this book. And so Mordecai, just so happened, because God providentially ordained that, he was the one who heard about this assassination attempt by Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold in verse 21. So this means these are guards of the palace. A eunuch was a man who had been castrated or had voluntarily castrated himself in order to get to this official position. He had no, there was no danger he wasn't a threat to any of the women in the palace, so he would be allowed to certain areas of the palace that other men would not be, and his job was to guard the queen and the maidservants and that type of thing. And these two are actually those that guard the threshold for the king himself. So they're part of the bodyguard, the queen's bodyguard, the king's bodyguard. And for some reason, we're not told why, they get angry with the king. They want to assassinate him. This is as if the Secret Service suddenly turned on the president. These people are in a position of power. These people are in a position, the king is vulnerable to not many people in the world, but he is vulnerable to his own bodyguard. And these two Secret Service agents have turned against the one that they're supposed to be protecting. But Mordecai just so happens to hear about this. And so he happens to be the one person who knows about the plot before it occurs. He happens to be the one person who has a daily audience with the queen. He can speak to the queen anytime he wants. There aren't many men in the land who can do that, but her adoptive father, her uncle Mordecai, can do that. And so he does. He tells the queen, she tells her husband. He follows the rule of law, has them arrested, has it investigated fully. It turns out that the plot is uncovered. Maybe they confessed to it. Maybe there was corroborating evidence. And they are executed for treason. Hanged on the gallows is the way that they did it. And then specifically the detail is given to us in verse 23, after they were hanged on the gallows, that it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So that little detail there is put there because later on that history book, that official document, will resurface and become part of the plot. So what's going on here is that with every part of the, just as in every part of the book of Esther, there's something far bigger at play than the minor details that we're seeing. Don't lose the forest for the trees. Don't focus too much on the details of these two guys and what they're doing that you forget. God is moving his pieces around, building a board where he can control what is happening, where he is in control of what is happening. So this singularly unusual event is recorded in the history books, but what was more unusual is that the king didn't reward the man that did it. I mean, Mordecai just saved his life. And there's no mention of any reward. So file that away, because the fact that Mordecai goes unrewarded for that deed is very important later on. And there are often things that happen in your life that you can't see the point of at the time, but later on in the narrative of your life, they become clear. There's often things that happen. Maybe you can even think now back to a time in your life where something happened to you, something happened to your family, and you didn't understand what was going on at the time, but now you can see what happened. You can see that it was all part of God's plan. One example I like to use is where my wife, Kim, she was studying at UCLA, and she had one class that she needed to take to graduate. She had to take a foreign language unit. And so she looked at the schedule of all the foreign language units that were offered at UCLA that fit her schedule so that she was walking back and forth to class, and she didn't want to have to walk twice up that hill. So she picked one that suited her schedule so that she would only have to walk once. And it was Afrikaans literature in translation. She didn't even know what that was, but it was what she needed. Now, for those of you who don't know, Afrikaans is a language only spoken in one country in the world, South Africa. She didn't even know this. She thought she was studying like African folktales or something. So she gets to the class, the guy's teaching the history of South Africa, the history of apartheid, to how these protest writers and literature in translation, they had to read. She didn't know what was going on. So she went and asked her boyfriend for help. And he said, well, I don't know, but I know this guy from South Africa, Clint. Here's his number. You should call him. Nobody understood what was happening at the time with her schedule, with her helpful boyfriend, who's a former friend of mine. But God knew. That little vignette in her life is part of a story that the children know as How I Met Your Mother. Now, one thing that we can meditate on from Mordecai's behavior is that even when the government leaders are godless men, it is still the responsibility of God's people to obey them and honor them. It's a Christian duty to honor them and desire good for them, if for no other reason that God uses political stability to bless his people. Let me say that again, because this isn't the main point of what's happening here, but it is a side application that we see, and we're about to see the opposite happen as well. But that Mordecai, in hearing that Ahasuerus has an assassination attempt brewing, he does the right thing to bless his leader. Now, Xerxes was not a pleasant man, and Mordecai could just have sat on that information. He could have just been quiet about it, and the assassination attempt might have been successful, and Xerxes might have been killed, and that really wasn't any of his business. But he felt the responsibility to look after his leader, and so he did this. And so it is a Christian duty to honor and desire good for our leaders, for our government, if for no other reason that God uses political stability to bless his people. Let me give you a verse for that. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. In 1 Timothy 2, Paul says, "First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions." Why? "That we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way." That's a really important Christian principle that we see Mordecai doing, and that we see Paul urging Timothy to teach the church at Ephesus. 1 Timothy 2:1, he's urging them to offer supplication, intercession, that's prayer on behalf of someone. Supplication is asking for something. Prayers of thanksgiving. We ought to thank our God for our government. We ought to thank God. We ought to supplicate God on their behalf, intercede for them. Not because they deserve it, but because the more God blesses the people in authority and the government and keeps it successful and keeps it stable, keeps law and order, the more we can just get on with the kingdom work. And if you've ever visited a persecuted country, you've seen how undignified the lives of certain Christians are, that they have to hide all the time. They have to gather quietly. They have to spend time and money and effort and stressful thoughts just to stay alive and be Christian at the same time. That's no way to live. And they do it anyway because they're being faithful. But what a blessing to live in a country that allows us to gather on a Sunday evening to worship God out loud and even provides us law enforcement to look after us while we do it. That, friends, is extremely rare in the world and in history, and is a blessing that we ought to thank God for. So even if you don't agree with the politics of local government or state government or national government, you still should be praying for them to at least keep things stable enough that we can do this. And this is what Mordecai does. Just do the next right thing. So that's our first point. Assassins reported. They were reported there. Now we move on to the second point in the narrative. Asinine requirements. Let's read chapter 3, first few verses. "Now, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him, and all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, 'Why do you transgress the king's command?' And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So Haman the Agagite gets promoted to a top-tier position in the kingdom. We would probably call him the prime minister. You know, he's not the king, he's the guy just under the king. He's in charge of all the other ministers, all the other officials, and he runs the country. He's the second in command, really, of the country. He's the head political official below the king. The king would have a general over his military, and he would have a prime minister over his executive branch. That's who Haman is. Very, very powerful person. And Haman, we find out, has a serious case of self-importance. He likes being the most important person around, and he likes other people to show that off. He's one of these people that insists on being called by their title. And here he insists on everybody doing whatever whatever is customary to give him honor, and everybody just does that because the king said to do that, right? He's pompous, he's conceited, he loves attention, and later we will see him bragging unabashedly about his achievements. Now, Mordecai, at this point, takes a different approach than the one that he took in chapter 2. In chapter 2, he obeys the king, he honors the king in order to keep the peace. Here, he does the opposite. Here, he disobeys the king. Here, he's acting like a rebel. He's actually breaking the law. He's torn Romans 13 out of his Bible. And he is just flouting this law. Well, what's going to happen to him? He considers it an asinine rule to pay homage to an asinine ruler. Now, in keeping with the secularism of the book, there's still no mention of why Mordecai does this. It says that the reason he gives the other officials that are asking this is because he's a Jew. So the implication there might be, well, he's refusing to bow down to this man and give him homage because Jews don't bow down to people. They bow down only to God. And you can think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to bow down to the statue and ended up in the fiery furnace. And they said, if God is able to deliver us, and even if he doesn't, we're still not going to bow down to you. So it might be a case like that. And a lot of commentators, if you read about it, they sort of, you know, Mordecai is one, a hero in the story. And so in keeping with his heroics, we say, no, this is a good example. I actually take a different view. I think what Mordecai is doing here is wrong. I think it's clearly wrong. Because paying homage to a person is not the same as worshiping them. And the reason I know this is because later on in the story, spoiler alert, Mordecai gets honored in a way where the king tells everybody to pay this type of homage to him and bow down to him, and he has no problem accepting that. So this, I don't think, is a conscientious objector saying I can't bow down because my religious belief says that I can't do it, because he doesn't mind other people bowing down to him. There's something deeper going on here. Now, it's not mentioned explicitly in the text, but the Jews who are very familiar with the Old Testament would make this connection because of little details that the narrator gives us that aren't necessary for the story. You know, the nationality and ancestry and ethnicity of the other people in the story aren't mentioned. Obviously, Mordecai and Esther, their ethnicity is mentioned because they're Jewish, and that's important for the plot. And there's one other person whose ethnicity is mentioned. Did you pick up who that was? Haman the what? Agagite, yeah. He's the Agagite. Now, in verse 1, it says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha. Now, in chapter 2, we're given Mordecai's genealogical details too. If you look at chapter 2, verse 5, says, there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel. His name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, the lineage of Mordecai is not a complete lineage here. There's huge jumps in that lineage. It's not talking about his father and his grandfather. I mean, unless he's 120 years old. That would make him 120 years old. That's not what it's talking about. It's giving a few select names that the narrator is weaving into the story in order to make sense of what's going on here. The names of the genealogy linking him to somebody very special in Israel's history. Do you remember who else was a son of Kish, a Benjamite? King Saul, the very first king of Israel. So that's the point here. Jair was the son of King Manasseh. And Shimei was a relative of King David. So Mordecai has royal Jewish blood flowing in his veins. And Haman is an Agagite. Saul was deposed by God from his position, and the position was given to David from the tribe of Judah for a litany of reasons. Saul was the ultimate tall, dark, and disappointing ruler. But the straw that broke the camel's back was that God told Saul to wipe out all of a certain tribe called the Amalekites. And Saul did that, except for one person. He kept the king. The king's name was Agag. So an Agagite is a person who is of the clan of King Agag. So what happens, if you remember the story, Samuel comes, what is this bleating of sheep I hear? What is this lowing of oxen? And he hacks Agag to pieces. But Agag didn't have his wife and kids with him on the battlefield, so his spawn reproduces, and there is a line of Agagites, a clan of Agag that lives all the way down to this point in history, and one of them is Haman. So Haman has royal Amalekite blood flowing in his veins. Mordecai has royal Jewish blood flowing in his veins, and he refuses to bow down to an Agagite. That's what's going on here. You see, there's something far bigger at play than just a personality clash. God is doing something. God has been doing something for centuries, and it's being played out in the lives of these two men. Haman the Agagite and Mordecai the Jew are mortal enemies. The Hatfields and the McCoys, locked in a blood feud that lasts for centuries. Now, what does this have to do with us? Let me read for you from verse 6 and on. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai. This is Haman. As they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, the Jews, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. So the way he's backing into this assassination, rather than killing Mordecai himself, he's going to come up with a plot to kill all the Jews. Now, this is a response that's way over the top. I mean, this is like mafia type stuff. What, you offended me, so I'm going to kill you and everyone who knows you. Your whole bloodline, anyone who's your nationality. I mean, that's just a big step up here. There's obviously something else going on here. This is a satanic ploy to wipe out the Jews, played out among these people. Verse 7, and in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman day after day. They cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So just explain what's going on there. Pur was a system of casting lots, kind of throwing dice. You would have a dice that has white and black sides on it, a die with white and black sides, and you would throw them. And two black meant one thing, two white meant one thing, and a white and a black meant roll again. That's how they would do it, and this was called a Pur. And two Pur in Hebrew language is Purim. If you've ever heard of the Jewish festival of Purim, this is where it comes from. It comes from this book. It's the only Jewish festival that the Jews instituted, the only biblical Jewish festival that was instituted by the Jews themselves and not by God. And it comes from that word right there in that verse. They cast lots. And what's happening here is this is a pagan ritual that he is... Haman is invoking demonic spirits here, I believe. He is doing a pagan ritual to figure out when he should strike the Jews. And like I said, this makes no sense in the story. One guy won't bow down to him, so he wants to wipe out an entire nation. Obviously, Satan is at work here, preying on God's people, as he does throughout the history of Israel, using the Amalekites, by the way, very often to do so. So that's what's going on here. He's casting these lots until he picks the month that it's going to happen. Verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad, dispersed among the peoples, in all the provinces of your kingdom. You know, the Jews, they're like an infection, they've spread everywhere. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them, which is not true. The Jews were good subjects, but it is true that they were a little different. They dressed differently, they ate differently, they had all these weird rules, and they didn't have laws like any other nation, because that's how God wanted them to be, separate. But they weren't troublesome. But he says, well, there's no profit in keeping them around. Verse 9, so if it pleases the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay, you know, out of my own salary, 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So this isn't even going to cost you anything. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. There's his little title now. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, do to them as it seems good to you. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps, to the governors, to all the provinces, to all the officials, to all the people, to every province in its own script, and every people in his own language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. That detail is given to mean that it has reached every corner of the known human world. It's translated. It's got the king's seal on it. This is happening. This job is done. These Jews, their days are now numbered. Verse 13, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So the casting of the lots determined that was the day that all the Jews would be wiped out once and for all, and you can keep their goods. Notice how there's a monetary incentive for the people to do this. And we see this happen. This played out in Nazi Germany. As soon as the Nazis made it legal for Germans to kill their own neighbors, and nobody did anything until they said, and you can plunder their goods. Then everybody rose up and said, well, now I'm going to take their property, I'm going to take all their silver and all of their gold. And that's when people turned on their neighbors. And that's exactly what's happening here. Verse 14, and a copy of the document was issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the people to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king. The decree was issued in Susa, the citadel. The king and Haman sat down to drink. Of course they did. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Notice here how Mordecai's little stubborn stand against Haman has consequences that are now spilling over to his city, to the state, to the country, and to the whole world. You see how his disobedience to government is actually causing the jeopardy of the lives of everybody dear to him. That's why I believe he should have just done what he was supposed to do. But this is all of the Lord. This is God's doing. God is putting the Jews in a position where there's no way to escape what's coming their way unless he delivers them. This is exactly what he did with them in Egypt when he led them to the Red Sea between a rock and a hard place, and then he split the Red Sea open to let them escape. And so even though he's not mentioned here, you have to see him working this out. When Eve ate the fruit that fateful day in Eden, the consequences of her sin and Adam's sin spilled over into the whole human race for the rest of human history. Conversely, when Christ bore the wrath of the Father that was deserved by you and me and every other human being on himself, he reversed that. He changed it. He preserved us. He made it possible for everybody to be saved, everybody who would believe in him, everybody who would look to him for salvation. And just as one man's sin plunged the human race into condemnation, it was one man's righteousness, one man's sacrifice that lifted the entire human race to a position of salvation. That now all men can be saved if they look to Jesus. Imagine he didn't come. We would all be doomed. Everyone would be doomed. No one's righteous enough to be saved then. But he didn't leave us. He came to preserve us. He came to save us. And that's exactly what we're going to be celebrating in the table this evening, the remembrance of that monumental, historical feat of God himself coming in human flesh and bearing our sins on the cross. And we're going to see a little microcosm of that develop in the story. So if you want to know how God uses a single woman to deliver the nation from destruction, come back next time when we're in the book of Esther.